I'm Alan Thorpe.
And I'm David Rogers, and together we host the Weather Pod.
In this special series on artificial intelligence, we invite leading experts to reveal how AI is being used across all sectors of the global weather enterprise.
We want to find out how business, the public sector, and academia are using AI. Can it help improve the accuracy and quality of weather and climate information?
Can it help to make weather and climate information more useful and usable across a range of critical activities that are impacted by weather and climate?
There are many claims being made about AI, but what is its real value when it comes to helping business and society meet the growing climate challenge?
Today, it's our great pleasure to welcome into the studio Amy McGovern to further discuss the use of AI methods and tools for weather forecasting. Amy is a professor of Oklahoma University School of Computer Science and the School of Meteorology. She's also the director of the National Science Foundation AI Institute for Research on Trustworthy AI in Weather, Climate and Coastal Oceanography, or AI2ES for short. Amy's research and that of the Institute focuses on developing and applying machine learning and data mining methods for real-world applications. This involves developing physics-based trustworthy AI methods, as well as explainable AI. These methods and tools are being applied to high-impact weather phenomena, including tornadoes, hail, severe wind events, flooding, drought, and aircraft turbulence. Amy, it gives me great pleasure to welcome you as a guest on the Weather Pod today and to share some of your thinking and research on AI and weather forecasting.
Yes, a very warm welcome, Amy.
Thank you. I'm excited to be here.
Amy, let's start by your institute that you head up, which is called AI2ES, which is, I gather, a short way of saying something a bit longer, which is the National Science Foundation AI Institute for Research on Trustworthy AI in Weather, Climate and Coastal Oceanography. So I'm glad you've got the shortened version there. So I wanted to start by you saying a little bit about what your institute is set up to do. And in particular, as you're doing that, perhaps you could just say a little bit about what trustworthy AI means.
Sure. So we are, that long name that you read out, but we are focused on creating trustworthy AI, and I'll define that, but I'll sort of define it circularly by defining the whole institute vision as you ask. So we're working on creating AI that our end users will actually trust and use in a variety of high impact situations for weather and climate and coastal oceanography applications. The broader answer is just sort of weather and climate, but working on creating an AI that helps them to both improve predictions and understand the foundational science behind these high impact phenomena that we're looking at, as well as improving the communication of all of that. And that gets me to the sort of what it means to be trustworthy, which is it really depends, by the way. There is not like a metric I can give you that just says this is going to be trustworthy AI. I know that might be a little disappointing, but we would like, you know, we want to be able to understand what our end users' needs are, and that trustworthiness comes through experience and understanding their needs and making sure that what we're doing is actually really meeting the needs that they have. And so in weather, it's a little different than some of the other applications because you're using these AI in situations that could be making life or death decisions. You could be, you know, deciding whether or not you're going to evacuate a whole area, issue a tornado warning, issue all sorts of really critical decisions. And you want to make sure that that AI is really trustworthy in the sense that it's going to do the right thing, that it's making predictions that people actually trust, that they work in their area, they work for the kind of weather that they're seeing, you know, that it's based in the laws of physics, all sorts of things. One of the interesting things that come out of our interviews is that weather forecasters in particular say that they understand that every weather model is going to get something wrong somewhere. One of the things they want to see with the AI is they just want to see when it's right and when it's wrong, so they know when to trust it and when not to trust it, which I think is interesting as well. It's like any NWP model. We all know they're not perfect. Maybe they will be someday, but they're not there yet.
So maybe AI will be perfect one day as well.
It's not there yet either.
Amy, who when you say users, so you've mentioned sort of operational meteorologists, and who else? I mean, there are others that are using this directly?
Yeah, so the end users, we're focused on our professional end users. So we're looking at forecasters, emergency managers across, since we're based in the United States, all, you know, across the United States weather forecasting agencies, but that includes NOAA primarily, but as well as, you know, FEMA and emergency managers, even just locally employed by, you know, TV stations and things like that, people who are communicating with the public, but primarily focusing on those professional end users that are the ones that are already consuming the products that are out there, looking at the NWP models, trying to understand what the forecasters are saying. We're trying to give them additional tools.
And the trust, again, to come back to the trustworthy, trust is to do with the reliability, the accuracy. What attributes do you feel can give trust or can enable the user to have trust?
I think probably all of the above on the list that you come up with, right? So it's going to include reliability and accuracy, but it's also going to include experience with the product. So the end users aren't just going to get handed a product and say, I trust this. They're going to want to see how the product works for them. We've found some interesting relational trust in that if they have other people they know that have used the product that liked it a lot, that they will start with a higher level of trust. Some of the end users, if you look in the AI literature, a lot of people make these broad claims of, well, if we had explainable AI, people would just trust our AI better. And I don't believe those broad claims. Some end users really want to see inside the model. And it is true that many of the current AI models, and I know your previous podcast defined AI and machine learning and deep learning and things like that. I'm generally saying AI to mean the broader scale, mostly machine learning, quite honestly, just using AI because it's the term that's used. Many of these AI models are really black boxes. And one of the things we found about trust that matters is that they want to see, some of the end users want to see inside that black box, but not all of them. Some of them just want to see the predictions. They really want to see case studies. They see how well it works on extreme cases. Some of them really want to understand whether the laws of physics are being applied and respected. Some of them, again, just want to focus on how well does it work for me. It's really a continuum, and it's a process. It's not like you can just hand them the AI model and say, here, please trust it. But I think that, you know, everything you're going to come up with is the answer is it's involved in some level, right? If you can't hand them an untrustworthy AI model and ask them to trust it. So there are some baselines that have to be respected. You know, if it's unreliable and non-accurate, why would I hand you a crappy model and say, please trust it?
Exactly. So, Amy, you actually just mentioned the phrase explainable AI. And I think you also mentioned this very much on your website about what you're doing. And it would be quite helpful, I think, to sort of introduce to our listeners who probably really may not have even heard of this term, it would be, you know, helpful to explain what do you actually mean by explainable AI. So can you explain the explainable AI? Yeah.
So that's a good question. And one thing I would add in my, as I give my answer, is that there's two terms that get used. And sometimes people use them interchangeably. There's explainable and interpretable AI. And I'll define it in a way that I differentiate between the two of them. So what we mean by explainable AI is something that you can develop as a tool post hoc. So after you've trained the model, so that you can peer inside to the model and try to figure out what in the world the model learned and why, what it thinks is important and which parts of the, you know, which parts of the storm, for example, it's looking at, or whatever, what it's doing, what's it focusing on in that weather model. Interpretable AI is really designed from the beginning to be a model that you could look at even when it's done training. So it's not, generally speaking, a deep learning model. Interpretable AI models are generally much more simple models, more like decision trees where you could just read the decision tree, but you can do an interpretable deep learning. It's just really hard. It's certainly an active area of research. That the idea of the interpretable model is more that you can look at that interpretation as soon as the model is trained. You could just look at the weights on the model and you could say something out of that model to understand what was important and what wasn't. So they're both important. They're just different model goals.
And just to follow up on that, to what extent do you think, I mean, you hear a lot that AI and machine learning are, quotes and quotes, just black boxes, and you get the answer that you get. And from that, I sort of guess that the ability to look inside the black box to explain how the neural network actually produced a particular system or a particular outcome is limited at the moment. So how far down the road do you think people who are investigating AI have got in terms of explainability?
That's a really interesting question. And there's a really There's something called confirmation bias, which is what I see a lot in the explainable AI method. So confirmation bias is you go in with your hypothesis and then you find something that confirms your hypothesis and you say, wow, I did it. And you keep going and you just don't look any further. And I see this a lot in the explainable AI methods. There are about 10, 12 sort of popular methods out there. And people will apply them to their deep learning model they trained on weather. They go in with a hypothesis of this thing is important, right? It's their physics-based knowledge that they have. They find the explainable AI method that confirms that hypothesis and say, okay, we use this method and it confirmed this knowledge that we have. And they don't look any further. They don't look across methods. They don't look to see what the different answers are and what else the model might have learned. And I find that a little bit frustrating. So I don't know if that answers the it's sort of going around your question of how far are we? I think right now we're not far enough along the path of creating explainable AI that's really trustworthy. We've got just the beginnings of it because we've got things that you can look inside the model and give you very different answers depending on which method you use for explainable AI. And then people aren't sure which one they should use. And so they tend to go back to this confirmation bias and say, I'm going to use this one because it confirms the physics that I know, even if this other method gives them a different answer. They don't know what to do with that answer. So they say, it must be wrong. So I think that we're very much at the beginning of that. And we really need to develop a more comprehensive set and more understand what each method brings to the table and then find a better way, especially ways that handle the laws of physics.
Okay, well, I think I wanted to come on to the laws of physics actually now, so that's a good segue into that. I guess in our opening episode of this special series on AI for the Weather Pod, we talked to Kirsten Dale from the UK Met Office, and she actually did a great job in describing a sort of hierarchy of techniques, if you like, in AI, so that the highest level is the phrase data science. And I guess then
she and I might have a disagreement about the hierarchy that she produced, but that's okay. It's a friendly disagreement.
Of course, I would say it's pretty confusing to others if there are disagreements on this, but anyway. I suppose from my point of view, these AI techniques in the end can be described as statistical methods, actually, a root cause. Now, I wanted to ask you about, because I've seen on things you've written and on your website that you refer to physical data science and physics-based AI methods. And you've already used the physics adjective quite a few times already in this podcast. And this is, I really want to go into this in a little bit of depth. What do you really mean when you say physical data science and physics-based AI methods? And in particular, are there non-physics AI methods? So is there a class that are physics-based and a class that are not physics-based? And I don't know whether perhaps you could bring that to life with maybe an example from some of your own research on high-impact weather.
Sure. Okay. So the putting the laws of physics into the deep learning methods in particular, which is what a lot of us are doing these days, is the deep learning. And by the way, Kirsten's hierarchy was perfectly fine, except for that she and I on AI and data science would probably go back and forth. I don't think that the Venn diagram of data science completely overlaps AI. I actually have a Venn diagram that goes with those terms that I use in my AI class. But the physics-based AI methods are really in their infancy. They're just beginning to be able to add the laws of physics into these different deep learning methods. And I think I'll give you an example from Kirsten also talked about this at the end of her podcast, from something that's really rocking the world right now in NWP, which is the new AI, generative AI methods that have come out from NVIDIA and Google and China. And, you know, there are a couple other places that are putting these methods out there. They're purely data-driven when they talk about them. So those have no physics in them. With a star, I want to put an asterisk on that. So hold on to that for a second. They're purely data driven in that they're learning entirely from data that's been handed to them, and they're learning to mimic that data going forward. So there's nothing inside the methods that say we have to respect the laws of physics, such as we're never going to go below absolute zero. You know, we're not going to just create something out of nothing. We have to conserve mass and all these sort of fundamental principles that exist in the NWP models. Now, my asterisk, I said I was going to come back to it. The asterisk that exists on those particular models is that they're being trained from NWP models, and the NWP models are respecting the laws of physics. So they're training from data that was created from physics-based models. They're just not using physics themselves right now. And that it almost isn't, some of the people who are creating these models like to say, oh, but they're physics-based because they were trained on data, you know, physics-based models. And I know Kirsten talked about how we're not going to be able to get rid of NWP, and I'm with her on that, right? Because the data assimilation methods that are creating these reanalysis data sets, for example, are very physics-based, and they're what's being used to train the vast majority of AI models out there. But I think the other half is that over time, we're finding ways to make the laws of physics actually embedded inside the AI models, and that those are going to then make even better AI models. One example of that that already exists is that they've taken NWP models, which are really an interesting statement of whether or not they're physics respecting, because they just parameterize the laws of physics in there. And a lot of those parameterizations are really slow, and those parameterizations are being sometimes replaced with just tiny ML models. And those tiny ML models can run much faster, thus enabling the NWP model to run much faster.
So, I mean, one interpretation of what you've said is, or one implication might be, why be bothering with AI? Because if they're already using physics-based NWP, what's the point? Why don't we just use physics-based NWP, which we've been using, it has to be said, for a long time.
And we have been using for a long time.
And it's proved pretty accurate in many respects.
I would say the answer is that we are on the cusp of being able to do a tremendous number of things with AI. And what those large scale models have shown is the tremendous speed up in AI. So in an NWP model, if I want to generate 10,000 ensembles, I have to run 10,000 instantiations of the NWP model, which is a lot of computing time. I mean, weeks of computing time to give me a 10,000 based ensemble. In an AI model, sure, I trained it on some NWP data, but now I have a model that I can ask all sorts of questions of what-if scenarios and get an answer with 10,000 ensembles in a few minutes. And that's a huge win. And that's just for those global scale models. You know, for the smaller scale models, AI has already proven its worth by post-processing NWP models. Again, another way the NWP is not going away, but that, for example, you take an NWP model that learned, that created something about the storms across, I tend to think on the United States scale because it's where I am. So it's looking at storms across the United States, but now you want to downscale it. You want to really see the fine scale features that are going to appear. AI can do really, really well at that. And it can do it quickly. And something that NWP models can't really do because they scale up exponentially in computing time as you scale down in resolution. You know, you make it, you can't do a 100 meter resolution model over the United States. You'll never get it done.
I can push back a bit on that because we've been post-processing NWP data for downscaling using statistical methods. They may not have been called AI. They may not even used a neural network, but they've been pretty close to that for quite a long time. So I tend to think, I don't know if you would agree with this, that it sort of divides into two, this AI work in weather prediction and forecasting. One part is speeding up bits of the system that we already have, which is great. The other bit, which you referenced these various papers from the big tech companies, they are looking specifically at being able to get rid of the NWP model for prediction itself, the day-to-day prediction. And that seems to me to be a bit of a different application, if you like. Would you agree that those two are somewhat distinct?
Yes, I agree. Okay. And I also agree that we've been post-processing models for a long time, but we've also been post-processing and using AI models for a long time. I've been doing this for 19 years and showing that AI can be useful for post-processing. But I think this new version of being able to just flat out do a generative AI model, we're not quite ready to replace the NWP out of that, by the way. But there is a lot of interesting promise out of that that I think that we're sitting on the cusp of.
Kind of related, what from a point of view of what's replaceable, I mean, we do a lot of work through our efforts with the World Bank on getting countries, developing countries, to be able to utilize the global centers products. And in our case, being based in Europe, we're often working with countries with the European centers, European Center for Medium Range Weather Forecasting, and using its global model, and you know, it's 100 member plus ensemble currently. And each country is said, oh, this is really very nice. Not every country does this, but many countries say, this is really very nice. And we use this as a boundary condition for our weather research and forecasting model, WRF, and we run that at whatever resolution, and usually it's not much better than the global model, but they have a sense that this is something that they can run themselves, something that they have, they can sort of own, they operate it, it's theirs. And what you're talking about in terms of using AI for downscaling, whether it has its antecedents in the work done for the last for a long period of time, or it's something new, it's clearly a tool that can help them better use the global model by downscaling, and possibly replace having to do a local assimilation, local modeling, which is sort of not really adding value. I mean, it really isn't doing very much, except they're trying to, in a way, they're trying to use it as an interpolation scheme to some extent. And whether AI, as you define it, would actually be a very useful tool to kind of replace that, to do that instead, rather than having a lot of people working on relatively inferior models at the local level, utilizing AI more effectively with the global, very high quality global models. What's your thoughts on that?
You asked Kirsten that same question too, and I think that it's an interesting question, and I think it's something that could happen. I want to answer it by going back one step also, because when we were talking about the AI, the two kinds of AI, there's other kinds of AI out there, right, that aren't being used, and some of them could address some of this question. So, for example, some of the reasons that the models are not very good in some parts of the world, particularly the global south, is that there's a lack of sensors down there. And so they're trying to take these, they're trying to find a way to take these global scale models and locally process them, because they know that they're already not very good down there because of the lack of sensors. And maybe they have access to some of the sensors that they're not feeding into the large scale database. Maybe they don't even have them. AI could be used to help both in that post-processing step, but also in just some creating some of those missing sensors. So for example, trying to assimilate in the global precipitation measurements that are available on a very irregular basis based on the satellites, but could we do something on a more regular basis? And there are companies out there that are trying to put satellites in orbit that are trying to help with some of these missing sensors. But, in the meantime, I think AI could be a big tool that could help with some of what you're talking about. So does every country need its own local weather forecasting? I don't know that I want to weigh in on that. That seems very political. I think they have reasons to have to want to focus on their local weather forecasting. But there's local expertise to be had, too, that's coming from these local scale weather models. And I think that that local expertise should not be lost. It's actually one of the things we're seeing in our interviews about trustworthy AI. Sometimes they'll say an answer of, well, this was developed in one region of the country, but is it really working in our region of the country? We want to make sure that it works for our storms. And I think that some of what you're talking about, these global models are not going to get, at least for a very long time, they're probably unlikely to get some of these finer scale features correct at the very, very local, orographic features, things that are being caused by the mountains, things that are being caused by the very nearness of the ocean. We'd like to be able to focus our models and create better models that work in that local region. So I don't see a way that we're going to make that go away. You're asking, are we going to replace it completely with AI? I think AI is going to be an augmentation.
I think I was more about augmentation, because it's more that you're dealing with models, local models, which are not particularly the latest in terms of capability, in terms of their physical representation of the real world. But at the same time, you have a tool that is extremely good at doing downscaling, and the quality of the global products is actually very, very high. But it's at a resolution in terms of the way you want to interpret it that is too coarse for the application.
And it's right. Well, you're never going to get a global model that's going to find tornadoes, for example. You're just not. It's a too fine scale of feature.
The biggest issue is probably rainfall and trying to get better rainfall, point-specific rainfall, for example, and that kind of thing. And if AI can address that and help, then it reduces some of the burden in terms of very high-end computing to run some of these local models. They still take a lot of resources.
I want to just pick up actually on something you said, just to check. I think you said AI can help us to generate observations that don't actually exist in a particular area, say the global south, which sounds a bit scary to me. as a physicist, you need to observe the system. So how can AI replace the need for local observations? Or did I misinterpret what you said?
I have to be careful in how I say it. I think AI can be used to help create synthetic observations, but those synthetic observations have to come from some amount of reality. Let me give an example from AI2ES's work. And I'll be specific about tropical cyclones. So tropical cyclones, we have two sets of satellite sensors that we can use to measure, sort of observe tropical cyclones. The visible satellite imagery, and those can be geostationary, so we could get very frequent visible satellite imagery, and the microwave satellite imagery. And the problem with the microwave satellites is that they're not geostationary, so they're doing overpasses. And they're doing them very quickly, and you get just a quick pass of, and you get, you know, some piece of the storm, because it's just what it could see. AI2ES is working on developing a synthetic microwave imagery that is trained from the visible imagery to give you what it should be seeing in the microwave imagery. And it's training it only in cases where you actually have both pairs, right? So you're training on the cases where you have visible and you have the microwave, and you could train it to look like that. And now you can now create synthetic microwave imagery from all of the history of visible satellite imagery that you have. So you now have a set of synthetic observations that you could use to study tropical cyclones. And you could do this in real time. As there's a new tropical cyclone forming, you could look at it with the synthetic microwave imagery. So you're creating that synthetic imagery, but it's based in some reality. But you should also know in your head, when you're looking at it, it's still synthetic. You're looking at it, you're looking at what the AI model has generated, but it's not ground.
So it does have some error characteristics, I suppose.
Yes. Well, in particular, it tends to be a little bit fuzzy right now. That's just an AI sort of model in general. It doesn't tend to be super sharp. But yeah, I mean, there's going to be uncertainty and there's going to be error characteristics. I'm not suggesting that we hallucinate observations completely out of thin air, and that's where I was trying to be careful. So
I think given the time, David, perhaps we should
press on. So Amy, you talk about how AI will revolutionize our understanding of and prediction of high impact atmospheric and oceanic science, and we all love the word revolutionize. What do you mean?
That's an excellent question. I think, you know, what I mean by that is that AI is really poised to help us actually do that. So we have these really high quality, huge amounts of data that a human cannot possibly understand, right? And AI can look for patterns in these large data sets. We're talking about like petabytes of data that humans are not going to be able to find. And AI can find interactions across variables that the human just never would have hypothesized and say, hey, have you considered this? You know, this gets us back to that confirmation bias we talked a little while about, because the humans might say, well, why would I look at that? But if the AI has found enough instances of the pattern, it might actually dive into it and say, well, that's actually interesting new science. When I started doing AI for weather 19 years ago, we wanted to do something that is only really just now possible. And I'll give you an example of that. And that is that we were trying to look at tornadoes and understanding tornadoes, and trying to really understand what causes one storm that looks identical on radar to create a tornado when another storm that looks identical does not generate a tornado. And the answer to that is that the radar is only one picture of the atmosphere. Now, if you can imagine that you could actually get a full, complete picture of the atmosphere, which might get us back to the synthetic data that we're talking about, but even I could just do it with NWP. If I could get a full picture of the atmosphere, I could try to compare these two storms and figure out what's going on. And AI can help us with that, which really is a scientific revolution. I mean, the same with the tropical cyclone. If I can go back in time and look at 30 years of tropical cyclones with a microwave imager that didn't exist, I might be able to find something that points to why we're seeing much, you know, for example, why certain storms are rapidly intensifying when they didn't expect it. I think that I use the word revolution on purpose, because I really mean it, because I really think that we can change our fundamental understanding of the science. It isn't just the prediction. And a lot of what we've done up to this point has been trying to just improve our prediction, but we're really ready to start changing our understanding of the science. And I don't mean that we're throwing out the baby in the bathwater. We're not throwing out all the history of all of the foundational understanding. We're building on that. And we're just providing new tools that let you understand these huge new data sets that people really just can't do on their own.
I think you point to a very interesting area of doing science and finding connectivity between variables, let's say, of the atmosphere. I mean, of course, we're used to having done work like that on things like teleconnections, But more generally, actually, the whole technique of data assimilation, which is about state estimation, actually, has worked really well in numerical weather prediction, exactly because if you measure one thing and you've got the laws of physics, it tells you about some other variable because they're connected via the laws of physics. So I suppose I'm going to, again, be in a position of slightly pushing back on what you said, that it might well be possible to utilize the data simulation methodology to be able to figure out those remote interconnections without necessarily seeing a revolutionary technique to have to do that. It may actually be embedded in that sort of approach. I don't know if you would, what you would think about that.
That's an interesting question. I think data assimilation and AI can benefit from each other. But you're asking whether I could just use data assimilation as it exists now, you know, Kalman filtering and 40-var and all these things to do these teleconnection discovery. I don't think it's designed for that right now, whereas you can design the AI methods that already exist to answer those questions. Can you find me an interesting new teleconnection to predict X, whatever X is? And data assimilation is really designed to just give you a consistent picture of the atmosphere, as you said. And it's also very computationally intensive. And that gets us back to the NWP versus the AI from before as well. And you can't really test out 10,000 hypotheses very quickly. And it leads you to people who have the computing power can do that. Whereas with the AI methods, I think you could do better at testing out some of these hypotheses in a variety of interesting ways that humans are coming up with, and that you could do them in a computationally feasible way.
Okay, I want to move on, if I may, to one or two other ways of describing the revolutionary nature of AI, if I can. I think, in a sense, one of the difficulties I find as someone who's been working in, if you like, the physics-based NWP approach to weather prediction, weather research and weather forecasting, is that the terminology that's often used suddenly is we're going to transform forecasting. There's going to be transformative forecasting. We've used the revolutionary word as well. And terms like generative AI, we're going to generate things that didn't exist before. And I'd be interested in you talking a little bit about that, but perhaps in the context that I feel at times there's a danger that we feel that we're throwing away all the accumulated knowledge of the laws of physics and how, in a sense, the atmosphere works. And of course, that knowledge is not static. It's improving all the time. So actually new physics is coming on board. And one of my issues is, can AI methods actually incorporate new science, new physics that is result of research that's done? So sorry, there's a whole host of potential questions there, but talk a little bit about your understanding of transformative forecasting and exactly how transformative will it be.
It's an excellent question, and you ask very long questions that have very in-depth.
I'm well known for it, so sorry.
I just want to make sure I answer it all, and it feels long. Okay, I'll start with the transformative part. I think that word has been used a lot, especially with these generative AI models that have been in the literature in the last few months. And the reason is that they feel like they're a whole new method of doing NWP without, we'll go back to that asterisk, without the NWP in the background, right, where it still has it. And I think the reason people are thinking it's transformative is that you can do something like these very large ensembles and these what if questions and investigate a whole lot of interesting sort of scenarios in a very cheap way. And that is transformative. I'm going to answer the other side of transformative maybe, and then I'll make sure I answered everything in your question. I'm not sure I have yet. The other side of transformative that I think sometimes people hear when they hear talking about AI is they hear it's coming for my job. And that isn't at least what I mean when I'm using transformative, because what I'm thinking of it is we're providing a whole new tool. We're providing a whole new suite of tools that the humans are still going to be in a team with, and still be providing critical information, which gets us to the other half of your question, that physics, the new knowledge is getting incorporated. The humans are going to be the experts still on that, and they're still going to be doing the retraining and the interpretation of the models and the actual issuing of forecasts, et cetera, so that we're giving them what I hope to be new tools to free up space to do other things, right? The forecasters are already really overloaded. We're not trying to create a automated forecaster. It is possible. I am not speaking for all of the companies. It is possible some of them are trying to create an automatic forecaster. We at AI2ES are not trying to create an automated forecaster that replaces jobs. We're trying to transform things by giving them a whole new set of tools that are more trustworthy and can act in a wide variety of situations, especially with the changing climate, that let them focus on making those really critical impact-based decisions. And that's another place, by the way, where transformative could be used is in the impact-based forecasting. Something right now we're forecasting a lot of just the phenomena, but not the impact. Imagine if we could also forecast the impact very quickly. Imagine if we'll go back to those scenarios about evacuations. If we could very quickly run an AI scenario that said, well, what if this part of the storm happens? What if this part of the storm happens? What if this part, you know, so you have five scenarios you want to run at these. Let's call it a tropical cyclone hitting a specific region. And then you want to run a couple of different evacuation scenarios. And you have some sort of AI simulation that can tell you what's going to happen with the people and how they evacuate. And you could get some really important, impactful information that would be able to better communicate the risks to your end users, right? Because in the end, we can't just say, you must evacuate. We can tell them that, but they don't do it. So if we can communicate those risks in some really clear ways, you know, with visualizations and with all sorts of, you know, if you don't evacuate, 90% of this area is going to be under 6 feet of water. You know, then they might understand that risk better. And that's something else that I think AI can do that's really transformative that I don't think we have the tools and the computing power to do right now. We maybe have the tools, but not the computing power to get the tools to run in the amount of time that you need.
But you're now touching on something that's very close to my heart, because that's sort of the area that I work in, and which is really the community interface, right? How people use information or don't use it. And we have the favorite expression is great forecast, shame about the outcome, because people aren't able to do things. And I think you've just touched on an area which I'd like to explore a little bit more, because I'm, you know, let's assuming that with all of the things that you're doing, we're definitely going to improve the forecast, but the impact end of it is still very much something in the forefront of everybody's mind. And it's something that we are doing in a very cursory way at the moment. It's very general, and it comes down to more than just whether you've got 6 feet of water or, you know, two meters of water, but whether you are actually reaching people who are differentially abled, who have got different needs and these things. I mean, to the extent to which we have information about communities and society, I'm assuming that we can use the similar tools, not to say the same, but similar ones that will enable us to understand what we can expect people to do. And this is something, and this is the question. So that was a statement. So this is the question.
And you think I'm wrong? Come on. Right.
It is a discussion, right? So that's where we're coming from. And now I posed this question actually very recently to others. So we have a situation where this week you're going to give out a forecast, and it's a forecast with all of the bells and whistles and all of the help that you can provide. And it so happens that that forecast is a bust. So it was a warning, but it did not materialize as an event that required any action on the part of people. Next week, we're going to have the same event, same kind of warning, but we know pretty much that people's behavior is going to be different. They're going to be more skeptical. The trustworthy nature of the, in this case, of the warning is going to be downgraded. They will kind of be suspicious that this is just yet another call from government which is wrong. So I'm actually talking to some people about the application of AI in this area. And so the question is, how you see bringing these pieces together? I mean, clearly there are different communities who are worried about behavioral science and can apply that. But do you see that coming together in the kind of work that you're doing, that we would actually be able to put this together in a timely way, not, you know, not a decade from now, but relatively quickly, that we can actually see the benefits of the application of AI across everything that we're doing, so that it's really helping us make better decisions and helping people, individuals, make better decisions.
And communicate those better decisions. Yes, I do. So in a related grant that we just started, we got funding from NOAA that we're working on trying to understand people's behaviors under flood warnings and looking at atmospheric rivers as well as just sort of normal flooding, you know, tropical cyclones coming in, as well as just a stalled system that just sits on top of you and dumps lots and lots of rain. I noticed you've been correcting me from inches to metric, so I'll leave my lots and lots of rain in general. But one of the things we want to do with this new grant is to study what people's reactions to the different types of messaging are, mm-hmm. so that we can then build better. So we're building AI models to help understand these, but then we can then use that to do better messaging. What you brought up is really, really important though, right? If we are the person who cried wolf, or the chicken that's always, you know, the Chicken Little, I don't know if that story exists in Europe, so maybe that's a bad reference, but the one that's always crying about the world getting ready to end, people eventually stop paying attention to it. And that's really important that we don't do that. And so I think that it's important we study, important we understand the messaging, and important we can build a better model of what human behavior is in response to the different types of messages, so that then we could do a better job of communicating, which is what we're trying to do with that new NOAA funding. And on your timescale question, by the way, that NOAA funding is very short timescale. So they want to have results in 18 to 24 months.
Oh, good. That's good.
It just started. So I hope to have a good answer for you soon.
It just occurred to me.
Flooding, but it's in everything, right? Yeah, I think your example is for everything. Yeah, sorry.
Amy, it occurred to me from what you were saying that about trust. I mean, again, your institute is called Trustworthy AI. And I think in this discussion, we've come back again and again to the importance of trust. It occurred to me, though, that there is a group that we also need to keep trust with, and that is scientists, with physicists and other scientists, that the new methods that are coming in via AI are indeed trustworthy in the sense that they do respect the laws of physics, which we, I think, as a community, gone to an awful lot of trouble to make sure we try to actually solve the relevant laws of physics, so that in a sense, our predictions are trustworthy because they're rooted in how the atmosphere actually works. So one of my worries is that somehow we're going to lose the trust of physicists, and more importantly, perhaps, that actually the next generation of potential scientists, students coming into the field, will say, well, we don't need to study physics anymore, we just need to study AI. Now, just interested from your sort of educator point of view, if that is a risk that you see being realized at all.
I think AI is transforming education, and it's a risk across every single field. And in fact, I just read an article this morning. I'm a computer scientist by training. That's what I started as, a computer scientist, and just read an article this morning that said that computer science is just going to go away in the next 10 years because AI is going to be able to do all the programming for us, to which I am very skeptical, by the way. But I have the same answer. I think we still need to understand the foundational principles, because we need to know when the system's gone right and when the system's gone wrong. And by the way, even though the NWP models are based on laws of physics, they still get things wrong. If they were perfect, we wouldn't be here, because there would be no need for the AI models. And so I think that the understanding those foundations is just going to be critical all the way through.
Hang on a minute. We could have perfect laws of physics and still not be able to predict longer than, because it's a chaotic system.
Well, yes.
So, you know, our knowledge, I think I personally think we have to be careful about, I mean, let me give you a specific example. Suppose I'm a cloud physicist, right? I'm spending a lot of research understanding microphysics in clouds, etc. And, you know, you've used the phrase synthetic observations, you've used downscaling from AI, we can do cloud parameterizations much quicker with AI, we don't need the parameterizations. I could get pretty depressed pretty quickly about my fundamental research here.
I would not want you to be depressed quickly about your fundamental research. I would want you to be excited that there's new tools out there, because there's still lots of unsolved questions to be solved. And if you have new tools, you can then use those tools to help you try to tackle the new questions. And I don't think that we're looking at, 10 years from now that we will have solved all the questions. I don't think that, as you said, there's chaos in the system, but I'm a Star Trek fan, and Star Trek looks all into the future, and you know that they didn't even get the weather predictions right in Star Trek. So they couldn't even think that, 300 or 400 years from now that they would get the weather right. They were just talking about Earth. There's a whole section in one of my favorite books that talks about how Spock was trying to solve the weather on Earth and then couldn't quite get there. And I think that there's still lots of fundamental new science questions. We're going to come up with new questions that we originally threw out because we couldn't answer them. Right? We said, well, that's too hard, but now we can do it.
Actually, come back to the cloud physics. Don't be depressed. To come back to the cloud physics one, since I used to dabble in cloud physics once upon a time, I think I would have found access to some of these AI tools to really have helped my interpretation of what is actually going on. It's like we didn't know a lot about processes. We had a lot of data that was extremely difficult to manage. And if you had these tools, you probably would have had much quicker insights into what is actually going on. And we're creating, at the time, creating the understanding of the physics. And it would have been very helpful to have had some of these tools to aid that. So it does. It could work. Wouldn't have made me so depressed. I think I've been quite happy, actually.
I'm glad to hear that, because I don't find it. It comes back to the same question I asked before. I don't find it to be something that we're trying to replace the forecasters. It occurs to me while we're talking about trustworthy, one thing we haven't talked about, it's a message I like to get in there, is that we at AI2ES are not just AI scientists or atmospheric scientists or ocean scientists working on these problems. We're also working with social scientists. And it comes in with the grant we just talked about, where we're trying to understand what the behavior of people is. We're trying to understand the communication of the messages. And I don't want to lose that in all of this, because when we're talking about trust, we were talking about a technical sort of physics-based definition of trust. But I think these social scientists and working with these social scientists and understanding what people really need and what they really understand and what messages they are taking from it is really critical, and something that we also can't lose as we go forward with developing these AI methods. I think sometimes AI scientists come in with kind of there's an XKCD cartoon about this. XKCD, by the way, has a cartoon about everything. I love XKCD. And they come in with a computer scientist of, we're here to solve your problem with algorithms. And the scientists say, but it's a really hard problem. And they say, no problem, we have algorithms. And then the next panel says 6 months later, and the computer scientist says, it's a really hard problem. Yes. And I think that AI is just another tool that's going to help us out, and that we need to keep this in mind, and we need to keep these relationships going. And to do that, we also need these social scientists who are helping us really understand what our needs of our end users are.
We've talked a lot about different aspects of AI, and we've gone from obviously the very strong connections with numerical weather prediction now all the way through into human behavior. And which seems extremely important that we'll be able to connect what we have been trying to do for a very long time, to be able to connect a forecast with the ability to communicate with people to get them to take appropriate action to prevent harm. I mean, some people study meteorology for the sake of it, and others are studying it to really understand what to do to prevent loss of life and loss of livelihoods. And I think it's in that vein that I'd like to ask this last sort of question from my side, and that is, if we look ahead, how much will we see improvements in this area? I mean, where is the biggest sort of change going to occur in this whole enterprise, what we call the global weather enterprise?
I think the biggest change you're going to see is that AI is going to become seamlessly integrated into all of the products that are being used by forecasters at all levels, at all the companies, at the private scale, at the government scale. And I think that's going to be a huge change, because they're used to, I think we started this with talking about how long NWP has been around. They're used to using NWP models. And seamlessly integrating AI into it is going to be a big change. I think this gets us to the crystal ball without you asking about the words crystal ball. And that is that I think over the next 5 to 10 years, we're going to see a seamless integration of very personalized weather forecasts that are being generated by AI. But the other change that needs to happen, which I think gets us to the question Alan asked a few minutes ago about being depressed, is that we need to make sure that we're educating our current existing workforce as well as our up and coming workforce about how to use AI so that they understand it and they see it as a tool and a piece of their toolbox, and they're not intimidated by it. And they don't think that, well, I just have to fall back on this method's been around for 50 years because that's the only thing I know, or it's the only thing I can trust. They understand that there's other tools in the toolbox, but they also need to understand that AI right now is being viewed as a very shiny hammer and not everything is a nail. So they need to understand when AI is an appropriate answer and when it isn't. And I think that workforce development is really, really critical. It's critical for the current workforce because they feel like they're being left behind. And it's critical for the up and coming students who are being trained and going to go into our workforce so that they know what tools they have and how they can actually do their best job of forecasting impact and communicating impact. And, you know, I've had people, for example, to give an example, I've had people that ask questions, well, can't we just use ChatGPT to give us the best impact, you know, to give us better forecasts, to reach the, to translate into the native languages, all these things that ChatGPT can do, but we don't have time to do. There's a lot of caution to put into that right now, right? They need to understand all the things that it has, all the upsides and the downsides, and they really need to have that training to be able to actually create the best sort of impactful forecast.
Well, that really concludes our latest episode of the WeatherPod in this special series on AI. I'd just like to conclude by saying so many thanks to you, Amy, for your thoughts on this subject. And it's clearly one that we're going to come back to again and again, and it's going to shape the future of the weather enterprise in the ways that you've described, which have been very thought-provoking. So thanks a lot.
Yeah, I think even an understatement. Really, thank you very much. It's really enlightening, this discussion with you. Thanks, Amy.
Thank you.
Well, that concludes this special AI episode of the WeatherPod. We hope you've enjoyed it. We'll be back in the near future with another episode dedicated to how the global weather enterprise is using AI and related technologies. If you have any comments, then please contact us at support@gweforum.org. Goodbye for now.